Welcome to our podcast, where we talk about everything there is to talk about from an LGBTQIA plus lens from across two places in Southeast Asia. I'm O.
And I'm D. And this is Queer from the Straits.
Hi, everyone. So today we're going to speak to Alaric Tan, who is a director at Greenhouse Singapore. Greenhouse is a substance abuse treatment center. And Alaric is a director there, and he is coming on board on this episode really to talk about what addiction means to him and what on the gaps that's currently in the Singapore substance abuse treatment process. So we're very thankful to have him on board.
I'm just really interested in hearing about addiction treatment, especially one that specializes for people who are LGBTQ. I think, you know, that kind of specialized care isn't really widely available in Southeast Asia. So yeah, I'm really interested and excited to learn more from Alaric.
Yeah. And if anyone wants to get in touch with Alaric, his website for Greenhouse is on our episode description. And I think they're doing fundraising now at the moment as well. So if you want to give, it's a holiday season, feel free.
Yeah, just a little content warning for listeners that Alaric does talk about some traumatic experiences he had as a child. He experienced physical abuse at the hands of his family members. And also, he does talk about experiencing conversion therapy, though not in detail. So just if these are maybe triggering for you, be mindful of that, though none of it is described in detail.
Hi, Alaric.
Hi.
Hello.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Yeah. So thanks so much for having me here today. Like always appreciate the opportunity to like share my story and recovery with others. So my name is Alaric Tan. I'm a 43-year-old gay man, Singaporean. I am the founder of The Greenhouse, which is a substance addiction recovery center for marginalized and vulnerable communities. So now I function as their executive director, basically running the center, making sure that everything is going according to plan, our growth, our expansion, whether we're meeting the needs of beneficiaries. Our beneficiaries are people who are LGBTQ, maybe HIV positive, formerly incarcerated. So like all kinds of people who may be re-traumatized by conventional care. Because there's a lot of stigma and discrimination out there for this kind of populations. So that's essentially what we do. We do, of course, serve a lot of people who are also maybe straight. We have some women who are sexually assaulted, so they only feel safe in a space like this. Essentially, 100% of our beneficiaries, they have had traumatic experiences. The average is actually 3 traumatic experiences. So there's often a lot of like anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, complex trauma. So these are the kind of things that we need to look at in order to help them to heal and grow. So strangely enough, we rarely address the substance use itself. We see it kind of like a symptom of the kind of pain that they are experiencing. So when we identify the trauma, we treat that directly, results seem to be better, more lasting.
Before we unpack those, because I've got a couple of more follow-up questions in relation to the bigger picture of, you know, what is the recovery sort of landscape in Singapore. But before you go there, maybe let's get our audience to get to know you a bit better. You know, because when I first read about your article, I think the Straits Times, it was a couple of years ago, right? When that was featured, I think two years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, when I first read it, I was like, wow, this guy is like, you know, you've been through obviously a lot. But do you want to talk a bit more about, I mean, it doesn't have to be what the article said, but, you know, do you want to tell our audience about, you know, what was your experience?
Well, I started using drugs in the year 2000. I was in Bangkok for a friend's birthday and someone offered me half an ecstasy pill. And I come from a very prim and proper family, very conservative. Like, it was a very big deal for me. I really thought very hard before I tried it, but I was assured that it was harmless. But from the very first time that I took that drug, I felt that I was incredibly hooked because it made me feel like I was a whole person, that the world was a safe place and people were nice. And I guess that I didn't realize that before that I felt that the world was unsafe or that people were bad or that I was not feeling whole or well. I guess even back then, there was a lot of mental health issues I was struggling with, like anxiety and depression that I may not have realized. So my usage over the next few years actually increased. It went from like 4 times a year to like every month, then every week. But I was still functioning very well. So like, I think a few years after that, someone offered me meth, which I was trying very hard to avoid because I actually know that's incredibly addictive. It's not a soft drug, it's a hard drug. It's as addictive as heroin, cocaine. And a lot of people don't know that before they try it. So when I tried it, I got incredibly hooked and I started using drugs almost every day. And I could not stop. And I tried to... So I was using for 16 years. 8 of those years, I was using almost every day and wanted to stop. And I tried everything. And nothing seemed to work. And it reached a point where all my loved ones felt that I was lying to them, that I didn't really want to stop. They did not believe me. They felt that I was making excuses for my behavior. So I felt incredibly alone because I could not understand what was happening. No one could understand as well. So I guess things changed when I went to a very, very expensive recovery center in Chiang Mai.
Yes. I've heard about that one, yes. They have an outpost in Singapore, right? Is that the one?
I mean, they are really very good. It's just very expensive. And basically, the therapist listened to my story, asked, you know, what my growing up years were like and all this sort of thing, and immediately said, oh, you have conversion trauma. There are essentially childhood adverse experiences. You're using drugs because you're in pain. These are bad things that happen to you. You are not a bad person and you can get better. And I had such a strange reaction to those words. I got incredibly angry. I felt like these things were not by choice. I did not choose to be traumatized. And yet, everyone thinks I'm such a selfish person for using drugs. But yes, finally, someone was able to explain to me what was going on in my life. That essentially I wasn't choosing to use. That there was pain that I was trying to manage. And I was trying to manage it in a way that wasn't helpful, but made sense in a way. So I guess it made me realize that when I was growing up, essentially, my family, my parents were having some struggles with their marriage. So they were fighting all the time. And I remember that my elder brother and I were hiding under the kitchen table, feeling very terrified. I was fostered out from the time I was born until I was 7, because my parents were busy working, so I wasn't sure where I belong. One of my earliest childhood memories was holding my mom's hand, walking down the street, and asking her whether she was my mother. Yes, I was bullied by a relative. Like, my arms and legs were covered in bruises. And that relative told me that I was unloved and unwanted and that I should just kill myself. So, yeah, there were a lot of these experiences I had which made me feel anxious, insecure, and depressed. And behind all of that, I was also struggling with my sexual orientation because I realized from a very young age that I may be gay. And I grew up in a boys' school and I knew it was unsafe to be myself. And when I finally worked up the courage to tell my parents that, hey, Dad, Mom, I think I'm gay, they were very hurt, they were very disappointed, they were quite upset. And they tried to figure out a solution. So they sent me to a place in Singapore where they tried to change my sexual orientation.
So it's conversion therapy?
Yes, basically.
Does that still exist? I mean, the program that you went to back then?
Yes, so the place still exists. I was quite shocked because a couple of years ago, I checked and they still exist. And from what I know, they still do it.
Is it faith-based or is it?
Yes, it's faith-based. Essentially, it's trying to pray the gay away. It's essentially letting the person think that we are homosexual because we have had traumatic experiences and our sexual orientation is broken and that we can reconcile with a higher power that can remove that brokenness and be whole. And so it was conversion therapy, but of course now that the research is very clear that it not only does not work, but it's very, very harmful, they have changed it to reparative therapy, as though there's something within us that needs to be repaired. Yeah, so
it's a semantic change, really, not really a...
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
And, I mean, is there any regulation? In the West, in the US, for example, I'm not sure if it is banned yet, but there was actually, some discourse around how conversion is child abuse and it's harmful. Is there a similar conversation in Singapore?
Yes, there are many countries in the world which have started to ban this deeply harmful practice. It's not banned in Singapore yet, but definitely a lot of professional bodies have started speaking up. The latest one was the Singapore Psychological Association. It was very moving, a very emotional experience for me to read their posts on social media, where they said very clearly research has shown that this practice is harmful, it does not work, and that people should stop doing it. So no, there are no laws in place, but people are beginning to recognize that it doesn't work and it's harmful, and they are beginning to speak up about it.
Just going back to your story, did you think that experience was one of the reasons why you turned to sort of substances later point in life?
Yeah, so I often feel like I need to be careful when speaking about this, because there are definitely people who are going to say I'm just making excuses for my drug use. But I love this saying by Neil deGrasse Tyson, I think. He said, the great thing about science is that it's true whether you believe it or not. So the fact that conversion therapy is deeply harmful is established fact. People may have a lot of opinions about it, but it's well-researched. People who have experienced conversion trauma have anxiety, depression, PTSD, complex trauma. They have higher rates of suicide risk. And something I read recently really got to me, research conducted and accepted in peer-reviewed publication, also supported by the American Psychological Association. They actually found that LGBT that were rejected by their families were 3 times more likely to use illegal drugs, 3 times more likely to have unprotected sex, 6 times more likely to suffer from depression, and 8 times more likely to attempt suicide. So when I read that, it really got to me a lot, because I realized that, no, I don't feel that I'm making excuses for myself, and a lot of people may have a lot of opinions about my drug use before, but if it's true that I'm just making excuses, why did addressing the trauma in my life help me to stop using drugs? So I feel that, yes, actually drug use is not just a mental health but a public health issue, because the kind of stigma and discrimination that marginalized and vulnerable communities experience, there is a healthcare burden. Essentially, my mom and I were calculating recently, we have spent hundreds and thousands of dollars literally on helping me get better. And it does hurt me. It is very stressful and worrying that conversion therapy still happens in Singapore.
That's terrible. I didn't realize it was still happening in Singapore until you said it. But is it publicly funded?
I wouldn't know. Yes. Okay.
That's something I thought would be quite interesting to know.
Versions of it exist in Malaysia that are definitely publicly funded for Muslim folks. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And I really agree with you, Alaric, that it's a health issue. And I think my heart goes out to you. You know, dealing with my own trauma stuff, I think it's helpful for other people to recognize that, you know, how you're behaving might be, however that is, might be related to your trauma. And I think that it's important to highlight this aspect of substance abuse, like you said, that it might be a symptom of dealing with your trauma.
Yeah, I thought what was interesting, Alaric, when you were speaking about your experience earlier was, you know, when you said that when you do, you know, drugs or whoever out there is abusing substances, whether it's drugs or it could be alcoholism or it could be pornography or whatever it is, right? There's almost this vicious cycle, right? Where you you do a certain action, like, you know, you do drugs or whatever, or you take alcohol, and then your family tries to help you, but then you know, you either relapse or do it again, and then it's hard to get out of that cycle itself, right? And it feels like that there is, and I think the experience for everyone is different, right? I would say, like, for you, you know, I was reading through an article, you found you didn't need to do drugs again when you felt sort of accepted by the people around you. There was a particular incident, right? Mm-hmm. That happened, I think, after you relapsed, I think, 3 times. Or yeah, I'll let you speak to that experience. I won't, you know, use my words to tell your experience. But I just want to highlight that, you know, that vicious cycle, to me, is something that is very hard to get out of, especially when there are elements where your family's involved, where your friends are involved. And especially for people who do not understand or has not been through sort of the recovery process, or has, you know, an insight into what that means, it's even harder for them to understand why addiction happens or why relapses happen.
Mm.
Right, and then it's almost like when you try to reach out to these people, or you know, your loved ones, your friends and family, because they don't have this yardstick of what that means, it's very hard for them to fathom what they can do to help you, right? Mm. And I think that's why then there's this narrative of like, oh, it's a choice, because like if I can, as speaking as someone, whether your loved one or as a friend who has not been through addiction and the recovery process, I think they're thinking from their own perspective is that if I can not do drugs, why can't you also not do drugs? So I think they're coming from a very their own lived experience, right? Which is, you know, to them is like, if I choose not to do it, you can choose not to do it. You know, I feel like there's that narrative that, you know, I don't have an answer on how you can get someone who has not been through that experience to understand someone who is going through the recovery process. Mm. But I feel like that's the dissonance between these two sort of groups of thinking. And especially like when you need your friends and family to be there for you. Because there is this other article that says that the enemy of addiction is connection, or, you know, or another way to put it is that, you know, the cure, so to speak, quote unquote, for addiction is connection to your friends and family. But it feels like to getting there is a bit of a challenge, because the two groups aren't really talking to each other if, you know, they don't have, if they're not talking from the same sort of lived experience. So I don't know whether you have a response to that, or have you been through that? Have you seen through Greenhouse any tactics or methodology that has been helpful in getting friends and family to understand what is happening to someone, to a loved one who's going through that?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question that actually outlines the recovery process pretty well. So I tried to answer it in like 3 parts.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the British journalist Johan Hari who said the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety, it's connection.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based on this, the findings from this research study where they put rats in cages alone and gave them a choice of either water with a drug or just water. And the rats were 100% of the time just drink the drugged water until they died. And when they look at the experiment later on, they realize, oh, this is not a good model of real life. So they put them in a cage with other rats and they made like a rat park. There were people to play with, they could have sex, there was food. There was basically socialization, and the rats that used to be addicted to drugs stopped using them. They just drank the normal water. They got better. And that's how it came about, this notion that actually the problem isn't the drug. The problem is whether we feel connected to others. So yes, a lot of our friends and family, they don't understand why we use drugs. They feel that we have a choice. We are bad people. We're being selfish. And so there's a lot of psychosocial education that needs to happen. Essentially, that's why we set up the Caregivers Program Health Center, where we help friends, essentially partners and family of those who are struggling with drug use, understand what's happening, understand how to help them in like safe and effective ways. Because sometimes when we ask them questions like, why did you use the drug again? Don't you love me? You know, why can't you stop using? Like, do you want to, you know, will you only stop when I die? That sort of thing. And that, like, there's a lot of shame and guilt, which is not helpful. If we see drug use as a way of escaping from a life that feels nightmarish to us, adding on to that experience is not going to make them stop using drugs. Yeah, so we've had good results. Like, definitely, it's helpful to the caregivers. They feel like they can cope better. They hold space for each other, so they are able to support the people who are trying to recover. But yes, based on that, I'd like to share like how I actually finally managed to stop using drugs, because. Mm-hmm. When I came from DRC, I was very committed to not using again. But I had 3 relapses, and I essentially was already attending a self-help group, like a 12-step program. And it was helpful, but I still couldn't stop using. And of course, people were judgmental. It's like, you've gone to prison. You know, this is your last chance. You are in a program. Obviously, you don't want to stop because these things have happened and you are not stopping. And so I had 3 relapses, and each one was worse than the last. When I use, I literally can't stop. I'm using not just every day, but every hour. And so I was really at my wit's end. I didn't know what to do anymore. And I attended a recovery meeting, and the strangest thing happened. I was sitting there sweating, paranoid, really anxious and disappointed in myself. And I realized for the first time that no one in that room was judging me. It was only me judging myself. They took turns to hug me, said that they loved and supported me, and believed that I wanted to stop using. And from that moment on, I just lost the desire to use drugs anymore. Since that day, I've never had a single craving. I understand now what it means to feel a part of a community that like loves and accepts me exactly as I am, without having to change a single thing, especially my sexual orientation.
Acceptance is so powerful, and you know, community is so powerful. And in my own journey with trauma, I watched this video by Brené Brown. I think it's called Listening to Shame, which we can link. She defined shame as, I am bad. And it sounds like, from what you just shared, that you were being told, or maybe even telling yourself, that you were bad. And this moment of transformation, it was when people stopped seeing you that way. I don't know if that resonates for you at all.
Yes, very much. So like, I guess I've never said it so directly before, but I feel like I was using drugs because I was ashamed of being homosexual. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when I finally showed my parents who I am, the message that they sent me when they sent me for conversion therapy is that this is not okay. It's not okay to be you. We need to fix you because you're broken. And when I failed to change my sexual orientation, it simply meant that I'm not whole, I'm not good, and I can never be whole and good because I failed to change. So this is why I feel like it doesn't matter the terms that we use, whether it's conversion therapy, reparative therapy, and recently they have a slightly nicer sounding term, but the underlying belief is this is bad and wrong and you need to change it. And if you can't change it, it's because you didn't try hard enough or you don't want to. So yes, I used drugs because I was ashamed of myself. I did not feel that I was worthy of love, that I felt like I was a burden to other people, and that I could never be good.
Yeah. How do you respond to someone, hypothetically speaking? And I've seen this in a lot of comments, obviously, when I read through Pink Dot or Greenhouse or, you know, sort of other substance recovery, you know, pages, where there's this narrative to say that, because not everyone who goes through conversion therapy does drugs, right? So there are, I assume out there is people who go through traumatic, not only conversion therapy, like traumatic phases of their life, but mm-hmm. they cope in different ways and they didn't turn to drugs as a coping mechanism or as a trauma response. So I think there is this sort of narrative to say that, oh, if I didn't turn to drugs, then why did you turn to drugs? And, you know, if I didn't do it and I went through the same traumatic experience you did or a similar traumatic experience, does that mean that I'm better than you? You know, just because I didn't do drugs. Do you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah, that's such a good question, right? And it's often used as proof that it's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I guess that's why the biopsychosocial model works very well. We are all different biologically. Some of us are maybe genetically more predisposed to addictive behaviors.
Right.
So they talk about like genes, right? But also growing up in a family where there's addiction, even like learned behavior, watching our parents use drugs or like use alcohol or gambling, we are more likely to model that behavior. So to me, whether it's genetic or not, it's not really important. But yes, it's true that some of us are more predisposed to using than others. But also the kind of like social environment, the people we hang out with, whether they use or don't use is likely to have an effect on us. But yes, and then the trauma dimension comes in, like trauma that's big T and small T. There are many kinds of traumatic experiences that exist on the spectrum. And some of us react better or worse depending on other factors. So yes, just because someone uses a drug or not doesn't make them better or worse. When our beneficiaries come for care or center, the thing that I say which seems to help them so much is that addiction, it's not a moral feeling. You are not a bad person. You don't have to worry whether it's a choice or not. We can help you, because if you want to get clean, we can look at all these things in your life. Your whole person, your addiction does not define you, and neither does your trauma need to define you at all. We can look at why you are unhappy, why you're anxious and depressed. We can look at ways to help you feel better. And it works. Like many of our beneficiaries get better, and it's not just our center. If the right kind of safe and effective care is provided, people do recover.
So skipping ahead a little, I think it's quite a common way to look at substance abuse as a disease. And if I understand correctly, that lens of looking at it was originally to destigmatize, because people think people use drugs, you know, because they're making a choice. Therefore, they are bad. So if we understand addiction as a disease, we can take some of the stigma away. Then you can get treatment, right? But I've read, and I wish I could find the source, but this I've looked before and I just can't seem to find it. But this approach of seeing it as a disease, but seeing it rather as like a way of coping with your trauma, or as a trauma response, really shifted how I saw addiction, you know, especially addiction that was in my own family, an addiction or substance abuse as a way to cope with trauma, though not a healthy or sustainable one. Is that how you see addiction?
So what you're saying is so important, because what makes the greenhouse unique, I feel, is that we provide data-driven, evidence-based, trauma-informed care. So data-driven as in we conduct our own research studies to establish why our target population is using drugs in the first place. And then it's evidence-based because we provide interventions that have been proven to work. Clinical settings, elsewhere, research studies, that sort of thing. And trauma-informed because we recognize the role that traumatic experiences have in their lives. So yes, we do not feel that for people who have had maybe complex trauma, traumatic experiences, that is a choice necessarily. It may have been a choice the first time they tried it, but the fact that they're having so much difficulty stopping usually indicates that there's some underlying issue. And so, yes, the disease model is definitely a progression in the right direction. It's true that substance use and addiction is definitely a disease, in that there are changes to the brain that occur when a person has used substances. And it actually shows up in brain scans. There are parts of the brain that don't light up as much anymore. So you have like low frustration tolerance, difficulty with higher executive order decisions. And then that's what they mean by it's a disease, because it takes time. We need to stop to let the brain heal. It's a chronic and progressive disease in that sense, in that if it's not treated, it's not rested, it will usually get worse. And a lot of people like to say that it's chronic, as in we have it for life and we have to be in recovery meetings for the rest of our life, which is true to some extent, but also very discouraging for people who are new to recovery. But to complicate things further, or to add a more effective way of looking at what's happening, is that yes, addiction is a disease, but it's not just a disease, and it's not necessarily caused just by trauma. The best thing that the Greenhouse ever did was adopt the biopsychosocial model of looking at addiction and recovery, meaning that there are biological factors, like the brain has been affected, the body may be affected, there may be illnesses that need to be addressed, there may be other things that need to be tended to, but it's also very much a emotional response to situations, psychological, the trauma aspect maybe, anxiety, depression, but it's also social, the people that we hang around with. Like sometimes our families could be also sources of trauma. And so we need to provide psychosocial education to the family to help them understand what's happening and provide support that's actually helpful. But the people that we hang around with, our circles of friends, we need to change that as well. So we look at the whole person, not just the addiction. We try to address all the different dimensions.
Mm-hmm. So maybe, Alaric, so you mentioned earlier you've adopted, what was the approach? Is it biosocial?
Biopsychosocial.
Biopsychosocial. Bio as in biology, psycho as in psychology, and then social as in sociology. Is that?
That's kinda right, yes.
Right, okay. So you're looking at these kind of three elements to kind of assess sort of the trauma response when someone comes into the greenhouse. What's that process like? Like if someone comes to the greenhouse who has not been there before, who, you know, wants to get on the recovery sort of process, like what does the process look like?
Yeah, so now we provide very systematic care. We have a three-step process, ICC, integrated consultation, community support, and then customized care. Which essentially means that we're looking at the biopsychosocial dimensions of their addiction and recovery. So we check whether there's been recent exposure to risk for HIV, other STD, whether there are physical problems that they need to identify and address, maybe see a doctor. And then the second part is the community support, where we make sure that they go to recovery meetings, meet other people who are in the same situation, who have managed to get better. And when they meet people like that, they realize that, oh, it's possible for me to recover. We need that kind of support network in order to heal and grow. Yeah. And the last part is the customized care, which is usually identifying specifically what kind of traumatic experiences they've had. And then like maybe doing initial counseling or group therapy to address those issues.
It sounds like an amazing approach and very holistic to have this trauma-centered approach where you take trauma as the root of addiction. So I'm just curious, how common is that approach in Singapore?
So recently we held a training workshop for counselors, therapists who may work with GBMSN, gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men, those presenting with substance use as an issue. And we had many esteemed community partners join this training workshop, both government and non-government. And it was quite a mind-blowing experience because we got to compare notes like, oh, this is what we are currently doing, this is what we're seeing, this is what's working, this doesn't seem to work very well. And so there were two takeaways from that workshop. One was that they really appreciate the safe space to share, because some of them came from organizations with a religious background. So they're not able to affirm the client's sexual orientation, which is part of what's required for them to heal and grow. But they really appreciate being able to like share safely without being judged. So even for people who provide mental health services, it needs to be a safe space for learning to occur. But the second thing that happened was that we realized that trauma-informed care isn't very common in Singapore, much less trauma-responsive care. Trauma-informed simply means that, oh, we recognize the role of traumatic experiences in a person's life, how it may affect the way they view things, and like how we can help them to recover. So we don't say, what's wrong with you? We ask, what happened to you? Because the first question is actually deeply judgmental. It causes more shame. It doesn't help them recover. The other approach, like, it holds space for the person. We can talk about what happened to you. Don't need to feel ashamed. We can address it together. And then, of course, the next stage is trauma responsive care, as in we are actively looking for the things that happen so that we can address them so that the person can recover. And yes, so my feeling is that the biopsychosocial model that we are adopting or we have adopted in Singapore, it's maybe not uncommon, but the trauma responsive approach, it's not common, I feel.
Yeah, maybe just expanding on these questions, could you give us like what is the landscape in Singapore in terms of recovery process for substance abuse? Like, I know you mentioned earlier in the episode that you were in prison, right? Is that correct? We can edit this out if it's not correct. Okay. So what happens when you go to prison for substance abuse? Like, what happens during, before, and after? Like, you know, what is the government sort of sanctioned process or procedure that, you know, if someone is going through that process, like, how does that look like?
Essentially, I do have to say, this is probably not a very popular opinion, that being sent to DRC Drug Rehabilitation Center did help me to stop using drugs, because I was using not just every day, but every hour. I could not stop using. It was simply because I was forced to stop using for 6 months by being sent to DRC that I felt that it was possible for me to get better. So essentially, it's a facility within prison itself. There is no criminal record. It's usually there for first and second time drug users. If you're not a trafficker, it's just like a small amount that you're arrested with, maybe, of drugs. But essentially, you are an end user. Then they send you there. There is no court procedure. Essentially, once your urine test comes back positive, they have the right to incarcerate you for 6 months. It's a 1 year sentence, but for first timers, like, after reduction, it's like 6 months inside and then 6 months on home tagging program. I've heard that's changed. Essentially, nowadays there's like maybe 2 months inside, 4 months in a halfway house, and 6 months home tagging program. Personally, I felt it was beneficial to me. But I have to say that from what I understand, the government has realized that when we incarcerate people like that, it's harder for them to reintegrate with society, which sometimes perpetuates the problem. So I've heard that for first-timers nowadays, they just send them for maybe urine testing and counseling. They don't send them to DRC, which I feel was a move in the right direction. But that also means that we need to increase recovery services. We need to make sure that there are more places that can tend to the needs of those who are not being incarcerated.
And what are the current available programs for that? That is, you know, that the government holds.
Yes. So while I was there for 6 months, they provided this drug intervention program. It was essentially 1 hour per session for 10 sessions. It was, I felt, very good, as in it was very direct, evidence-based. This is how you cope with urges. This is how you examine the kind of like unhelpful thinking that you have, and you can change it. So it's kind of like a little bit like the smart recovery program that we provide now. I did think it was very good, but essentially what I felt might not have been provided was the trauma-informed aspect of it. I did not feel that my trauma was identified or addressed. So I don't wish to comment on our, you know, the system that's in place now.
Right.
I don't necessarily feel that it's bad or wrong, but I do feel that there are things that can be added to it to make sure that more likely to stop using drugs in a sustained manner. I feel that care could be provided in a way that doesn't shame the person. That it's important to recognize the role of trauma for at least some drug users.
And I wonder, I mean, you chose to start Greenhouse in part because you felt, or I think maybe I'm assuming this, but maybe you can answer, like, your part of your focus is helping people who are marginalized in terms of their sexual orientation and identity, and was the response because you felt like the existing services didn't really take into account if you are a sexual or gender minority?
So I guess the realization I had in that pivotal moment was that peer support was the missing piece for my recovery. I feel that people who have been traumatized need to feel safe in order to learn anything at all. If we are still feeling unsafe, if we are very guarded, if we don't feel like we can open up and be ourselves without judgment, there is no like digesting of information and changing of the way that we think or feel. So yes, I actually just rented a space and invited the groups that were doing these recovery programs to hold their meetings there. And over time, it grew in a very organic fashion, and people came and joined us and started lending their experience, expertise, so that we could like do our research studies, introduce programs and form a system, do it more consistently. So I'm deeply grateful. I am very touched that a lot of people find value in the work that we do and have come on board. But yes, essentially, the focus of our center is that if you feel that if there's a lot of stigma and discrimination that you're struggling with because other people may not understand, this is a place you can be yourself in without any fear of judgment or discrimination. And that's when we can try out different programs, see what works for you, and like you can, there's a lot of learning and changing and growing that can occur in this safe and supportive environment.
Mm-hmm. So why did you decide to open Greenhouse? I know you mentioned the missing puzzle was peer support. Like, was that the main reason why you opened Greenhouse, or is there anything, like, what was the impetus for it to, you know, to make you want to, you know, embark on this on this journey?
So like I guess the thing is mom and I actually had to pump in a lot of money to set up the center.
Mm-hmm.
And it required a lot of like lifestyle changes on my part as well. We use up all our savings, and people have said that you have done such a noble thing. You are so selfless, but I do not feel that way at all.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that for so many years I struggled with this alone, and that the people who loved me could not understand. I could not understand. People felt that I was selfish. I was being very irresponsible. That I was a bad person. And finally, when I recovered, I realized, no, I was none of those things at all. I was in pain. And when that has been addressed, I will get better. And that made me see that there are a lot more people out there like me. And they should be given the opportunity to recover as well. So that was why I set up the place, because I don't know whether it's just the LGBT community that struggles with this kind of issues. Now we start to serve more people, like victims of domestic violence, women who have been sexually assaulted, straight men who basically struggle with societal expectations. They also benefit from this trauma-informed approach. They also feel that they are in a safe and supportive place, and they are recovering because of that. So yes, I think that I set up the place because I realized that addiction is poorly understood, that trauma-informed responsive care is important, and I'm hoping that what we are doing will resonate with more people. So we're actually very, very touched. Like the highlight of our year was Minister Shanmugam visiting our center in July, I think, just 2 days after we celebrated our fourth year of operation, because we never thought that there would be recognition for the work that we do. We just got a charity status, and essentially we thought we serve these people who are so discriminated against, so poorly understood, so highly stigmatized. People who are LGBT, HIV positive, formerly incarcerated, they are not bad people. They are just dealing with a lot of stigma, discrimination, minority stress, and it was wonderful. It was deeply meaningful and touching that you know, government agencies are beginning to see value in the work that we do, and would like to work with us or support us. We are very, very touched. Yeah.
And for those of our audience who is not in Singapore, Shanmugam is the Minister of
Home Affairs.
Is it Home Affairs? Okay.
Yeah.
Mm. Minister for Law and Minister for Home Affairs. That's right. Yeah.
Right. And I mean, what led to that? Like, did they approach you for him to come over to the center, or what? How is the public sort of body's reaction? Like, you said it's like 4 years ago, right? Like, hasn't been a progressive engagement with the public sector and public officials.
Essentially, I think there's been quite a few media articles, like Straits Times, Mothership, we are part of Birthday Book, and Today. Like, so definitely whenever we talk about, whenever I share my story, whenever we talk about the center, the services, there's more attention, there's more recognition. Like recently, Maybank and Majority Trust, they also gave us an interest-free loan, the Momentum Grant. So a lot of people are beginning to see value in helping people recover from substance use, because I think before it was quite stigmatized. It's not a very popular cause to support. So the more that we talk about, hey, people are using drugs because of these reasons, they're good people, they can get better, more people come on board and want to support us and support not just us, like the recovery landscape in Singapore, right? Yeah, so definitely I think like addiction recovery does fall under like Ministry of Home Affairs. I think it's within their ambit. Yeah, so essentially I think they may have heard of us, and like we did send them emails, let them know this is what we are doing, that we need support, we hope for their support. So we were very surprised and also very grateful that he saw it fit to come and visit us.
So one of the articles I read about Greenhouse, I think because of the population that you serve, it is harder to convince people to support it financially. And so now with this new charity status, have you seen a shift? Do you think it'll be easier to get support for the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so I guess getting charity status means that whoever donates money to us is assured that there's proper checks and balances, that we are doing what we say we are doing with the money, that we are using it in ways that benefit the beneficiaries. So yes, it's really very hard for us to raise funds. It's not a popular cause. The people we support are like, it's quite stigmatized, it's sometimes very sensitive. So we are trying to We're trying to work up our fundraising efforts. But yes, it's been an uphill struggle. We are beginning to see more donations. But yes, it's always been quite difficult to raise funds.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I know we are almost at an hour. So maybe last question I have, like, do you think there needs to be some kind of paradigm shift in terms of the recovery landscape in Singapore in the future? And I think that relates to, you know, I'm curious to know what the plans that you have for Greenhouse in the coming years?
Yes, that's a great question to end this on. Yeah, not that I'm in a hurry, but like, so actually when, let me see whether this is politically sensitive.
You can cut it. With it.
I think it's okay, yeah. So, okay, it's essentially, the Greenhouse has a vision of setting up a sober house. Because a lot of halfway houses in Singapore, they are funded by religious bodies. So understandably, maybe it's not a great place for people who are LGBT to stay at, because sometimes they're asked to change their sexual orientation. There are places that don't accept those who are HIV positive. And I think for most halfway houses, you may have to be arrested in order to access the services. So we want a place where we have more control over the person's environment. So at night, essentially it's a shelter. Those who have been rejected by their families, thrown out of home, have somewhere to stay. Someone who may need detox, but, or someone who needs a more controlled environment can stay there without having their sexual orientation change. They can be themselves, but in the daytime, they'll do something like urban farming to help the nation with food security. And maybe they can have a soup kitchen to prepare food for the hungry, because this is the part that's missing for a lot of people who are trying to recover a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning. They need to feel like they have something to offer to society, that can do something to help others. And in the daytime and in the evening as well, there'll be the usual recovery programs and services, counseling, therapy, that sort of thing. Yeah, so we are trying to move beyond just the biopsychosocial model, which is essentially what the three parts are about, into biopsychosocial spiritual. Spiritual not as in religious, spiritual as in a sense of meaning or connection to others, a sense that I have value and worth as I am, and I can also serve our society, that I can be a part of something meaningful.
That's great.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah. Sorry, just for my own, we can cut this out from the pod. What is a halfway house? I'm not very familiar with that.
So halfway houses are, for example, if you go to prison, DRC, and then you are released, you may stay there for a while before you go for your home tagging program. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Right. And you're saying that your greenhouse is looking to set up a sober house, which is something similar or something completely different?
So I guess the concept of a sober house is that anyone who needs to recover in a safe and supportive environment can essentially have their biopsychosocial spiritual needs met in a very holistic and integrated fashion. They don't need to be arrested to access this care. And we are hoping to offer it at a very affordable price, because it's not that such places are not available overseas. It is, but for it's really, really expensive. So most people will not be able to access that level of care. And that kind of care is required for lasting recovery to happen. Yes, and this place is essentially trauma-informed, trauma-responsive, and we want to serve the needs of those who may be re-traumatized by other services, people who are marginalized and vulnerable, like LGBT, HIV-positive, those who may have been sexually assaulted, physically abused.
And just on that, like, how has the response been from the other sort of organizations that's working in this landscape, like, say, Narcoholics Anonymous or the rehab centers in Singapore? Like, has there been good engagement from them? Like, is there a community where, you know, you're working with them? Or, you know, how is that looking like? Is that a fair question? I don't know whether that's a fair question.
It's a fair question. Yeah, so I always feel that the greenhouse is privileged to be part of the recovery landscape. In working with these community partners, people who are providing similar services, we want to work together, because no one person or organization can do it all. And for example, we have to send some of our clients to IMH for psychological evaluation, medication, and then they come to us maybe for peer support, and we do refer them to other counseling services as well, places like WeCare, Uga Chaga, etc. Yeah, so it's the working together that I feel is super helpful. So this new place that we are setting up, we don't see it as a we hope that we won't be working in a silo. We hope that we'll be working with other community groups, and we see if this works. We hope that cross training will happen, a lot of referrals. I guess what we are doing, it's new, but it's not completely new in the region or other countries or what, and we're hoping for support from community partners. It's quite new though, sharing this news that we want to do a sober house. You're probably one of the first people to hear about it. We so far only shared it with Mr. Shamugan when he visited our center. He's been helpful and supportive. He's been referring us to several government agencies to see if we can work together.
Awesome. I did have one question. So, I mean, how, you know, I mean, because it can be very stigmatizing to seek help because of the stigma, people feel, you know, afraid to come forward to get treatment. Are your services confidential, or is there a, like, have to do reporting? Like, yeah, I'm just curious about that aspect.
So we could be the only anonymous addiction recovery center in Singapore. We don't take down any identifying information. We actually assign them a case number when they come into our center. So essentially, I think the most important thing is that we want to help, but we want to help in safe and effective ways. There is a lot of stigma and discrimination, so it's natural that people who want to access care feel frightened. And sometimes they're frightened because of lived experience. They have been told that they're bad or wrong, or they have been shamed, people have used the wrong pronouns. Yeah. So yes, when they come, it's anonymous. I lost track of the question. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. No, it's okay. Yeah, I was just.
Yeah, my question was just, are your services confidential? And I think you said you're one of the only anonymous treatment centers in Singapore. So is that not typically true in Singapore? Is our services not typically anonymous?
Yes. Well, this part is quite sensitive because I'm not sure whether our community partners will feel like we are competing with them or saying they're not as good. Yeah. But yes, essentially we could be the only addiction recovery center in Singapore that operates on an anonymous basis.
Okay.
We'll leave it as that. We can cut. We can cut that part off. Yeah. Don't worry. Okay. We're almost at the hour. Dee, do you have any last questions?
Yeah, I think I have maybe it can be a two-parter. So the first one is, what would your advice be to someone who is experiencing addiction right now? And the second would be, is there something that you wish someone in your life who you confided in that you were using substances had said to you when you were still using drugs?
I feel that for people who are trying to get better, it's very important for them to know that addiction is not a moral failing. They are not bad people. That sometimes we may have had experiences that make us anxious and depressed and unhappy, but those are things that can be addressed and we can get better. And if people around us don't believe that, that's okay. There are people who believe that we want to get better and will support us. That safe and effective care is available, not just our center, at many centers, and that we don't have to be ashamed of what we are doing. It doesn't define us. For many people who recover, there is post-traumatic growth. We don't just reclaim the life we were leading, we come back stronger. And I think for those who are supporting people who are struggling with substance use and trauma, it's very important that we don't offer advice because we haven't had those experiences. If we cannot help, we should do no harm. It's very helpful to learn how to hold space. Holding space simply means being present with the person without any agenda, letting them say what they want to say, share how they're feeling without any form of judgment. And when they feel safe, because we are not imposing our values and views on them, we can offer them options that these are places that they can go to for care and that we'll support them and we'll assess these services together with them.
Great. I think that's really helpful.
Yeah. For sure. And I mean, just to end the point, I mean, thanks, Alaric, for being so, upfront about your experience. And hopefully, this episode will get, more people to donate to Greenhouse, or if they know a loved one, or if they themselves are going through substance recovery, they can look out to reach out to Greenhouse for help. And just on that, like, how can people start that journey with Greenhouse? Like, what would you recommend people do if they want to approach yourselves or Greenhouse in itself?
Oh, so we have a website, www.thegreenhouse.sg, spelled out in full. I recommend going to the website first because there are some recovery stories you can read. People who have gone through addiction and gotten better. There's also like a list of services available. And then there's a contact form at the back where they can essentially drop us an email. I'm the only one who sees the email, don't worry, so I won't be sharing the email address with anybody. And from there, we can set up the intake assessment appointment. Intake assessment is 1.5 hours. Essentially, we are trying to find out what kind of traumatic... we are trying to establish like baseline, what's your using pattern like, frequency, you know, how heavy it is, and then explore what could be causing the substance use, and then come up with a recovery plan together that will help them get better. So that's how they get started. And just using the opportunity to mention, there's also a donation page there. We currently are running a fundraising campaign on giving.sg. The link is there. And every dollar we receive between now and end of March, it's matched by the Tote Board Enhanced Fundraising Program. So every dollar is doubled.
Great. Awesome. We'll link to all these in the episode description.
Yeah.
For sure.
And we'll put it on our social media.
Yeah. Thanks so much.